Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s. And each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
It's Joe Benigno and Evan Roberts on The Fan.
Joe and Evan. Evan and Joe. On WFAN Sports Radio. In the New York, no. Gotta go to Joe and Evan. Evan and Joe.
All right, 404 on The Fan, hour three of our radio program. Joe and Evan in the afternoon, 877-337-6666 is the phone number. Here, of course, till 6 o'clock, Mike Francesa will come your way. Ernie Acosta in Manhattan will live from the Town Fair Tire studio with nobody on top of that beats Town Fair Tire. Nobody.
Book came out a couple of months ago. Tremendous book. Took me about 2.5 days to read it. So good job out of the author who joins us right now, John Shea. 24 life stories and lessons from the Say Hey Kid. John, Joe Benigno, Evan Roberts here in New York. Thanks for coming on. How are you?
John, how are you?
Joe, Evan. Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for writing the book. I mean, it was very entertaining. What I liked about it, and for anyone out there who wants to read it, you should. It's like two different voices. We have you writing, and then we've got Willie jumping in with thoughts from a lot of individual moments throughout his career and growing up. Where did the idea come from on kind of structuring it that way?
Well, yeah, thank you. 15 years ago, I actually asked Willie about it, and he seemed to be all in, and one of his first reactions was, I'd like to see this book in classrooms. So therefore, life lessons, not just life stories.
Right.
And, you know, studio autobiographies are tough because you could tell reading page to page to page, man, that doesn't sound like him. That doesn't sound like her. And I didn't want to fill in the gaps with anybody except for Willie. And I spent more than 100 hours with him on the project and 200 plus people I interviewed so that the story, while we know about Willie's career and what he did and the four home runs in Milwaukee and the catch at the Polo Grounds at 54 and on and on and on, it seems so many books had like 35 pages of bibliography, and this was taken from a previous book, which was taken from a previous book. So this book is 100% new, you know, fresh, exclusive stuff. Anything between quotes that was ever said previously was off limits here. There is no bibliography. It's all about what Willie is saying now, what
right.
Everybody who knew him through his life and career is saying now. So the boldface Willie, in every page, he weighs in on everything. It's his book. We're co-authors. I thought would provide a fresh way of a breezy read, an easy read, a read that people of all generations could enjoy and appreciate, even if you didn't see him live through his career or anything like that. So he's trying to gear it toward kids, but in reality, you know, old timers who saw him play, I understand from people who get in touch with me, they love it too.
John, what motivated you to write the book on Willie?
Well, I grew up here in the Bay Area. I saw the end of his career, late 60s, early 70s, and obviously he's everybody's favorite player. And then when I returned to the Bay Area, I was covering baseball, covering the Padres in the mid-80s in San Diego, and returned to the Bay Area in 88. And by then he was back with the club as an advisor or just being Willie Mays. That's enough title. That's all you need. And unlike a lot of these Hall of Famers, he's in the clubhouse all the time in terms of pregame access and with the players and the coaches, the managers, the writers. And we just developed a nice relationship, and thank you, over time. And I wrote about him as much as I could. Who wouldn't in my position? And obviously he trusted me because he kept talking to me. So we sort of hit it off that way. And once we got engaged in the book, we just spent all this wonderful time together, not just at his home, but out in private, out in public. All the access he gave me was just, unparalleled. So I just think that, my relationship, in the Bay Area, my relationship with Mays, and the fact that maybe his story wasn't told as I would like to have seen it, right, all weighed in.
Well, let's go back, because one of the things, there's so many things from this that intrigue me, but one of which is the move to San Francisco and the fact that he's not accepted by that fan base, that he was always being compared early on to Joe DiMaggio. He's great, but he's no Joe D, and that he would routinely hear boos, which is just, it's crazy to hear about. We talk in New York about booing Edwin Diaz for blowing a save. That's one thing. This is Willie Mays, who at this point is one of the best players in all of baseball. He's come to your city, have a major league team. What about that aspect of the difficulties of just not being accepted by the fan base in San Francisco upon that move?
Can you imagine that? All the New York fans who adored him, read about him in the paper or see on TV, and what, the guy isn't fully appreciated? What's the matter with those San Francisco fans? Well, now the Giants play at 24 Willie Mays Plaza, and the first statue you see is of Willie Mays. But back then, this is 1958, and you're right, Joe DiMaggio played with the old San Francisco Seals, and for some old-timers here, he was the guy. There wasn't going to be anybody else who was going to come in and play his position in his town at his ballpark, Seal Stadium, who would be any better or as good. And, they obviously didn't appreciate the great Mays, his five-tool prominence, his six-tool, and everything he delivered on and off the field. In fact, he had a hard time even buying a house in a white neighborhood in San Francisco. They turned him down initially. Right. It was a black eye and embarrassment to the city of San Francisco and the mayor, who spent so much time trying to get this team from New York. And they finally did, and they wouldn't even allow the best player, not only on the team, but in baseball, to be in a community that where he wanted to live. An easy commute to Candlestick Park and Field Stadium. So, the next day, obviously, he did get his house. The whole story behind this and other stories in the book is, Willie got his way, but not just for him, but, for the next minority family that came into that neighborhood. And so he fought it. He wouldn't let it go. Other people might have said, okay, I'll go down the street or elsewhere. The mayor said, stay at my house. He said, no, I want this house. Kept fighting for it. He got it. But, that's his story. Anyway, probably not until 1962. Many years later, a few anyway, since they moved in 58, when the Giants won their first pennant, and, thanks to Mays, who had a great September, great best-of-three series against the Dodgers, because they, in 51, they tied over the full season, so they had to play a best-of-three. So Mays went off at the end and carried the team, and they played the Yankees in the series. They lost in seven. McCovey lines out to Richardson. But it was Mays who finally got his full recognition from all these old-timers. And again, a great majority of the people just adored him from day one. But there were some in the media, some old-timers who loved Joe more, that were slow to adjust to the great Mays, and I still can't believe that.
John, I want to go back, because I think that's a fascinating part. You're talking about he wasn't accepted in San Francisco. What was Willie's mindset leaving New York, though? How about that? What did he think about leaving New York and now having to go out to the West Coast?
He didn't want to go. He felt comfortable there. You remember the early years, all the great pictures we have of him playing stickball with the kids in Harlem and then moving around to different parts in the city. He knew the clubs. He knew the people. He knew where the jazz clubs were. Obviously, the fans loved him. He loved the fans. He always had an affection toward kids. And why are we leaving? Well, we're leaving because New York suddenly is a one-team town for whatever reason, and two teams are leaving for the coast. So he didn't want to leave, and it took him a while to get adjusted because he was so familiar with New York. having come from Alabama and starting his minor league career with the Giants in Jersey, and then moving on to Minneapolis, and then finally in 51 he got called up in May by Leo DeRocher. But he didn't want to leave. But San Francisco was great overall for him. I mean, the Giants had the best record in the 60s. Marichal had the most wins in the 60s. They just didn't win any World Series once they moved west until, you know, Bochy shows up in 2010. But, yeah, looking back, Mays, I think more of a regret was that he wasn't able to finish his career as a Giant. He said while he loved coming back because he called New York home to the Mets in 72, he kind of wished he could have spent his whole career, you know, like Mickey Mantle and Joe DiMaggio and these guys, with one team. So it's a regret, but he still loved the fact that he got an opportunity for 2 years with the Mets.
Talking to John Shea, author of 24, great book written by John and Willie Mays. You know, going back to 51, probably the most famous New York baseball moment, even though for a lot of us it's history, we don't remember it, was Bobby Thompson hitting that home run. But the great trivia question is who was on deck, and it was Willie Mays. And what I thought was so fascinating, the way you laid it out and Willie laid it out, is you get into that situation, and it's tough. Let's think back all these years. There's second and third. There's one out. The on-deck hitter is this young player, Willie Mays. You got a base open, and Branca's numbers against Mays were tremendous. He was 2-for-16 against him. He was in a massive slump. If the Dodgers walk Bobby Thompson, all right, we're recreating history, and Willie Mays is up, does Leo DeRocher let Willie Mays hit?
He said later he would have. He said later Mays would have gotten the opportunity to hit in that situation. I mean, Mays had the awful start, 0-for-12, 1-for-25, the only hit off Spahn, the home run at the Polo Grounds over the left field roof. But he eventually got his numbers up, not to the great level he saw later in his career, but good enough to hold his own. You're right. He didn't really want to hit in that situation. He was a bit nervous. He's a 20-year-old kid, a year out of high school, graduation. Signed in May of 1950, right after he graduates from high school. In May of 1951, he's a center fielder for the New York Giants. So you fast forward that, of course, the great comeback, the Giants over the Dodgers, and Mays is on deck. And he says now that at the time he was nervous, but he learned from that moment because he eventually grew to cherish those key crucial moments in games where, you know, he often did come through and witness the 62 series when he hit that double with two outs in the ninth inning of game seven to keep it alive and put two guys on and two outs before the McCovey line drive.
You know, John, we're talking to John Shea, who wrote this great book, 24, about Willie, with Willie Mays. You talked about those teams in the 60s, and I remember them well. You know, the 60s is my, you know, growing up period of watching baseball. But they never won anything. I mean, you mentioned the one World Series they lost to the Yankees, and they had these teams with McCovey and Mays and Marichal and Gaylord Perry and Cepeda for a while till they traded him to the Cardinals, and Gaylord Perry and all these guys, you know, that were on that team, Jim Ray Hart. But they didn't win. I mean, how did that affect him? That they, you know, they had, you know, a lot of teams, good teams, high profile team, but after that 62 season could never get back to a World Series again. How about that?
And those Giants, as good as they were, there was always a team that was better. They finished in second place 5 years in a row, by the way. And it was always a game or two games or three games.
Right.
It was always one in the final weekend. But Gibson's Cardinals had a great team. Or Koufax's Dodgers had a great team. It was always one other team. And even the Cubs, you know, all these Hall of Famers, they were last place, but they were still darn good. I mean, there was no slouch team. There was no 1993, Marlins or Rockies or whatever. That came along until 62 when they started adding more teams, 61, whatever. But Mays took it okay because I talked to Ralph Perry about this, who gave up the Mazeroski home run and then faced McCovey 2 years later in another game seven. And what if McCovey's line drive actually got by Richardson? Ralph Perry would have just gone out of his mind. And so what, two times in that amount of space? Are you kidding
years.
Me? But right. Luckily for him, you know, Richardson catches the ball and he wins the game. But yeah, it was tough on the Giants, but Mays always took it, as explained in the 62 chapter, the high road. He didn't let things bother him. It was all about winning. He talked about how 40-40, if you told me it would have meant something, I would have done it. Right, what's wrong with 660 home runs is not like, third all time for the longest time was okay. But more than numbers, he did care about winning, but when he lost, he didn't wear it. He didn't let it bother him. He just kept moving on. At least that's how he talks in the book. So lesson learned, I suppose.
You brought up what Willie said about, and I always think about this, that, hey, if I knew 40-40 was a big deal, would have done it all the time. You did a lot talking about the new age stats, war and how guys from the past are measured. And that's why sometimes I think it's so difficult, even though you take a stat like WAR. Willie Mays is an all-time great with it. It's not like WAR devalues Willie Mays. In fact, as you pointed out, he probably should have won more MVPs because of it. If we were judging players based on the way we judge them now, Willie Mays probably has a handful more of MVPs. But it's also difficult to judge people on stats that they didn't know even existed. Because I think there were players, and maybe Willie's included, who says, hey, if I knew that this mattered or I could do this and this is going to improve my WAR, that numbers would look very different. And that's why sometimes it's so difficult to go back and say, this is what those guys' numbers would look like using kind of the numbers of 2020.
And he did win two MVPs in 54 and 65. So at the time, he was the youngest player ever to win an MVP. And then in 65 was the oldest player ever to win an MVP. And you look back and, Mike Trout could have won it every year, like LeBron or Jordan and these guys. They put up the same numbers every year. It's just mind-boggling. And that's what Mays did, because he was terrible. He played 150 games plus for 13 straight years, one of my all-time favorite Mays stats. And that's a record. That'll never be broken. Ripken didn't even do that. 13-plus years, and that was much of that was during the 154-game season. But you're right, two MVPs, and you look back, and I interviewed for this numbers chapter, Bill James and Eno Saris and Rob Neyer and Tom Tango, Bill Arnold, all these guys who are historians and writers and statisticians, and they helped break it down. And leaving those conversations, I'm thinking to myself, doing the math, he could have won 8 to 11 MVPs, not two. Yeah. When you look at the WAR, and we all, now we know all about WAR. You're right, but they didn't, it wasn't a factor. More RBIs was a big deal back then. Willie's thing was always, I wanted to score 100 and drive in 100. And obviously, that's a huge deal, even in today's game, but RBIs just aren't valued like they are.
You brought up that, because I had to go to Baseball Reference as soon as you brought it up in the book, is 1962. I mean, with all due respect to Maury Wills, how is he the MVP over Willie Mays? I mean, it's not, because he stole 104 bases? And I know the stolen base has kind of gone away, and I don't want to take 104 stolen bases and say it doesn't mean anything, but Willie Mays clearly had a better year than Maury Wills. Wasn't even close.
And that's what it was. It was like, hey, you win a triple crown, you're going to be the MVP, even though Trout has a better year. You steal 100 bags, well, you're going to be the MVP, even though Mays had a better year. It's the same thing. But you look at the base, you look at the breakdown, and it's not like Maury Wills' runs total increased heavily over Mays's because of the stolen bases. They scored the same number of runs.
Yep, right.
Mays had like more than 100 RBIs, all the home runs he hit. But and by the way, the Giants won the pennant and the Dodgers didn't. So what possible reason?
Right.
You look at the WAR, it's like 10 plus versus half of Willie's WAR is what Maury had that year. And we broke it down with Willie. I'm going over year after year after year. And one thing Willie says is he doesn't think pitchers should ever win an MVP, and Koufax won one year. And this is right when the Cy Young Award was coming into baseball, by the way. And he just thinks, and all the hitters, right, think that MVP should go to hitters. What are pitchers getting it for? Because they got their own award. But yeah, you could break it down over those seasons. The WAR thing, like a 10 WAR season is absolutely brilliant. 10 WAR season, 10 wins, and it's been done only like 9 times since 2000. Mays did it 3 times. Trout did it 3 times for hitters. Well, Mays averaged a 10 win season over 7 years in the 60s. Average, wow. And this is something that nobody in today's game has come close to doing.
You know, John, as a Met fan since the beginning, 1962, I was very excited in 1972 when Willie, you know, wound up with the Mets. He had a home run in his first at-bat as a Met and all of that. But the 1973 World Series, there were some embarrassing moments for Willie in that World Series. I mean, he clearly was not the guy he had been before. He had that terrible game in Oakland when he fell down a couple times in the outfield trying to make plays. You know, he wasn't the hitter he was, you know, obviously in the years before. How about that? How about specifically his thoughts on that 73 series and like I said, just some of the embarrassing moments that he had?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and I always thought that as well. You know, the images of him falling down when a ball is hit to him, the images of him kneeling down at home plate arguing a call.
Right.
So
right.
I tried to go back and look into it and talk to as many people as I could who were there on both sides, Oakland and New York, along with Willie himself. And I found a lot more information that we produced in that chapter, you know, talking with Crane Pool and Kuzman and Seaver and all the A's, Vita Blue and Raleigh Fingers and Reggie Jackson and Ray Fosse, all the particulars on both ends. And there's a little bit more to the story than those images. And one fact is, you know, Willie, that was his worst year. It's the first year in his life he went on the disabled list. He's 42.
Right.
And he thought he was just going to, you know, finish the season and move on. But the Mets, last place in August, win the division and beat the Reds in the playoffs. And Willie didn't play from September 9th all the way into the postseason. So he was off virtually a month because of some busted ribs he suffered in Montreal when, as a first baseman, hit his side up against a rail in foul territory. So he was shelved for a month. And then finally, he gets a little playing time in the playoffs. And then World Series game one, he's in the lineup hitting third in center field. So it's not like he's mid-season form.
Right.
He's not in his prime. But anyway, game two is what everybody looks at. Game
right.
two is
right.
when he did fall down, when he was kneeling at the plate. Well, I talked to Reggie Jackson, who was the center fielder on the A's in that same game. And he said that was the most brutal sun he's ever experienced. Oakland in the twilight is pretty bad. Half shadows, half sun. And Mays didn't even know he was playing center field that inning. He came in late in the game, and then when he went into the outfield, he thought he was playing right because you know he went in for Rusty Staub, but Don Hahn was in right. So two guys go out to right field, and then they both look into the bench, and then they wave Willie over to center. And then sure enough, like half a minute later, Darren Johnson hits this bloop single to center, and he loses it in the lights. Well, if he lost it in the lights 10 years earlier, nobody would have thought anything of it. But now he's 42, so he's done. He's old man. And everybody says, well, don't be Mays. Don't be that guy who plays too long,
yeah.
before his time and all that stuff. But you know, I talked to Ricky Henderson and all these guys who played well into their – I mean, Ricky was playing independent ball in his mid-40s and almost, you know, almost didn't go to his Hall of Fame ceremony because he had a game, you know, that kind of thing. But and they all say, hey, you know, you play as long as you can, even if you're the great Mays. And that's what Willie did. He was only making $165,000. It's not like, you know, he could go off and make that money elsewhere back then.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's a lot more to it. And by the way, when he was kneeling at the plate and arguing a call, it wasn't because he did anything wrong. He was arguing in defense of Bud Harrelson,
right,
who
right.
was called out at the plate
yep,
on the play
yep.
by Fosse. And no one on the Mets thought that was a good call. Huggy Donatelli. So Mays, who was on deck, was the first of the scene and was arguing vehemently for a teammate, not because he did
right.
something wrong. So
well,
there's a lot more to the story. And everybody who played with the Mets that I interviewed just absolutely loved the guy.
Well, what I also loved is the story you mentioned, how when he got the game-winning hit in the 10th inning, that he may have deked Ray Fosse into calling a fastball because he was complaining, and I can't see because of the backdrop. And that it all may have been kind of a way to get that fastball from Raleigh Fingers, and he hits it up the middle for a base hit. So I mean, that's the sixth
yeah,
tool,
that,
right? That's the brilliance.
That was the game. That was the game-winning hit. Yeah,
right.
I mentioned that. Yeah. But all those things that happened in the game, he just happened in the 12th inning to get the game-winning hit, and it was after an 0-1 count. Willie backs off and says loud enough for Ray Fosse to hear. Said, "Man, I can't see that ball. I lost that ball. You see that ball, Ray?" And then Willie gets back in there, and obviously Fosse calls the fastball down the middle, and Willie punches it into center field for what proved to be the game-winning hit off Raleigh Fingers, the Hall of Fame closer. And by the way, Raleigh Fingers had a great story. Well, Raleigh Fingers, as a kid in L.A., his favorite player was Willie Mays. He was a center fielder as a kid. So he goes to Dodger Stadium one day, and his dad says, where do you want to sit? He said, I want to sit beyond center field so I could watch Mays. So he saw Mays, and then after the game, he went down the parking lot to see if he could see Mays walk out, and all these Dodgers were moving out, all the, you know, Koufax and Drysdale and Wills, they're all, and then in the corner of his eye, he sees Mays on the far door over here to his left, and so starts chasing him down and gets Willie to sign a ball at his car, and Raleigh Fingers doesn't see Willie Mays again until he the 73 World Series, and then Willie gets a base hit off him. And then Raleigh doesn't see Mays again. You know, there's no interleague play. Doesn't see him again until he's inducted into the Hall of Fame. So he's a Cooperstown. And he tells Willie the story about how he got the autograph as a kid, and then he faced him in the World Series. And he said, Willie, if you didn't give me that autograph, I would have drilled your ass. And then he said, no, I wouldn't. I wouldn't have done that to Willie. But it was a funny story that is in the book.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Joe.
No, go ahead. You're there. Go.
Well, I was going to say it's a tremendous read, and it really does a good job of getting into a lot of individual stories from his career. I mean, the Spahn-Marichal game, which I think the anniversary is in a couple of days, the greatest pitcher's duel of all time, a duel we're never going to see again.
16 innings.
We're never going to see a 16-inning game where both starters stay in the game. And oh, by the way, Willie Mays hits the game-winning home run against Warren Spahn, who throughout his career, and you pointed it out earlier, how he hit he got his first major league hit against Warren Spahn, a home run, and who knew it would be a sign of things to come, because he always had great success against Warren Spahn throughout his career.
And Marichal, who was young, Spahn, who was old, in his 40s, but he has the most wins of any left-hander in the history of the game, the most wins since the 30s of anybody who's played since. And, you know, against Marichal, you know, both high-kicking screwball artists who just kept pitching into the night, the 9th, the 10th, the 11th, it's 0-0, and now it's the 16th. And Marichal retires Hank Aaron and a couple of other Braves, and it's coming off the field and tells Mays, he said, Willie, man, the skipper's going to take me out of here. You got to help me out. And Willie's the second hitter of the next inning. He says, okay, I'll see what I could do. So he hits a home run. And then he tells me in the book, for the book, he says, man, I didn't know I didn't hit a damn home run. I thought I could help him out a little bit, especially a candlestick, because nobody was hitting that day. The wind was just killer. It was freezing cold. And, talking to Warren Spahn's son, talking to Bud Selig, who was there, talking to Hank Aaron, who played in the game. It was just amazing that they ever built the place there. And one of the coldest nights was that 16-inning game in which Mays hit the walk-off home run against Spahn on a screwball that Warren hung and lived to regret it. But, it was Warren Spahn who gave up the most home runs to Mays, but they were close buddies and, future Hall of Famers.
You know, John, one more game I want to throw at you and get Willie's reaction to was the Juan Marichal bat over the head of Johnny Roseborough game. I believe it was 1965, and I think it was Koufax against Marichal in that game, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
What was Willie's thoughts? I mean, obviously he wasn't involved in any of it, but what was his thoughts on that?
Well, he was the one figure, the peacekeeper, that kind of made sure it didn't get even more out of hand. Koufax would never come inside intentionally, never brush back anybody, but Marichal would, and he did that game. And it was at the end of a heated series between the Giants and Dodgers,
right.
Candlestick Park. And Johnny Roseborough, the catcher, said, well, I'll just take this into my own hands. And he threw when Marichal came to the plate, he threw a pitch. He threw the ball back to Koufax and clipped Marichal's ear. And Juan turns around and clubs him over the head with the bat. 14 stitches later, he's out for who knows how long, but it was a 14-minute delay, 14 stitches. And it was Mays. While Roseborough wanted to go at Marichal and just kill him, it was Mays who grabbed Johnny Roseborough by the jersey and pulled him off the field to the Dodger dugout. And there's some wonderful pictures of Willie Mays in a sea of Dodger blue all alone as the one guy from the opposing teams that the Dodgers would say, okay, you could pull our guy off. But imagine anyone doing that now. It just doesn't happen. But Willie was the peacekeeper. And Marichal and Roseborough, just despised each other. And then they became teammates. That's Juan's last team, believe it or not. And they became friends. And Juan didn't get in the Hall of Fame the first couple of tries, even though he's one of the greatest all-time pitchers. in my favorite Marischal stat, more complete games than wins. And the same, by the way, for Warren Spahn, more complete games than wins.
It's crazy.
But anyway, they became friends, and it was Roseboro's words, hey, you know, don't take it against this guy, or don't not vote for him because of what happened. I forgive him. Only then did Marischal finally get in the Hall of Fame.
John, excellent book. I really enjoyed reading it. I recommend it to everybody out there. 24 life stories and lessons from the Say Hey Kid. And we appreciate you coming on.
John, thank you, man.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Thanks, Evan. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, man. Have a good one. John Shea, the author of 24 Life Stories and Lessons from the Say Hey Kid. A lot of games we didn't even get into or discuss in this book. But it's I like the format. We mentioned it at the top. You know, he's writing about Willie's career, and then kind of Willie chimes in with specific thoughts from a lot of big moments throughout his legendary career.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.